So, Revelation chapter 12, let's start reading in verse 1. The Apostle John gets another aspect of this vision that he's in the middle of. It says in verse 1, a great sign appeared in the heavens. So he looks up to the skies and he sees some sort of a sign. He says, a woman was clothed with the sun and the moon was under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. And she was with child. And she cried out, being in labor and in pain to give birth. And so there's this pregnant lady up in the sky. She's 9.5 months pregnant. The baby's coming. She's screaming. She's in pain. And then he says, okay, so there's a woman and a child. So one thing we're going to have to figure out here is who is the woman and who is the child? But there's a third character here. Then another sign appeared in heaven. So he looks over here. And he sees something else up in the sky as well. A great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns. And on his heads were 7 diadems or crowns. All right. And so over here, you've got the woman giving birth. Over here, you've got the dragon with the heads and the crowns and the horns. Who's the dragon? We're going to have to figure that out, too. And so his tail swept away 1/3 of the stars of heaven and threw them to earth. So the dragon's like, whoosh, and 1/3 of the stars just crashed down. And then the dragon moves over to the woman who's giving birth. And he stood before her and she's about to give birth so that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. So this woman, she's got enough problems already, okay? She's in labor. She's given birth. And she kind of looks over around the sheet and she's like, that's not a doctor. It's a 7-headed dragon with 10 horns and 7 crowns. This delivery is not going well. Talk about the delivery from hell, okay? And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. Unfortunately, just before the dragon gobbles him up, it says her child was caught up to God and to his throne. So the dragon's like, hum, and the child's gone. And then the woman fled, understandably, into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God. How long? Well, there she would be nourished for 1,260 days, which incidentally is about 42 months or 3.5 years. Remember last week, those numbers came up. They're going to come up this week twice. They're going to come up next week as well. And then there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. You got to stop trying to eat pregnant women's babies. The dragon and his angels waged war. There's some sort of battle going on here. We don't know what it's about. And they were not strong enough. And there was no longer a place found for them in heaven. The dragon and his angels, that is. And the great dragon was thrown down. The serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth and his angels were thrown down with him. And so we've got to ask ourselves, who are these characters in this vision, in these two signs that John sees that merge with one another? And what are the events? We've got to interpret this vision. Who are the characters and what are the events? Well, let's start with the dragon because he's the most straightforward. John actually interprets this for us. The dragon, it says, is Satan right there in verse 9. The great dragon was thrown down. He's the serpent of old who is called the devil and Satan. We see him show up from the very early pages of Scripture, interacting with the first human beings that God has made, talking them into turning away from God. He talked them into the fall, what Scripture calls the fall of humanity, where the human race turned away from God and brought a whole host of problems into this world. The male child is Jesus Christ. And this is really not debated by anyone either. Revelation 12:5 says, a male child who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and to his throne. Well, if you read a passage in the Old Testament, remember our Old Testament background for the book of Revelation, we see Psalm chapter 2. The Lord said to me, you are my son. This is a psalm, a chapter of scripture that was well known even in that day to be about the Savior, the promised one. God promised a Savior would one day come. The Lord said to me, you are my son. The New Testament affirms this is about Jesus. He says, I will give you the nations as your inheritance. The whole earth is your possession. You will smash them with an iron rod. You'll break them with an iron rod and smash them like clay pots. So we see a ruler with ultimate authority to rule the whole earth, to rule all the nations. And notice what Revelation 12 says. You see the rod of iron. You see ruling the nations. You also see this baby is caught up to God and to his throne. What a perfect description of Jesus Christ, who after his death and resurrection, he rose into heaven, seated at the right hand of God the Father. Now the woman. Who is the woman? This one is up for a lot. This is up for debate here. This is more controversial. You've got three main options that people have come up with throughout the years and up to this present day. You've got the Mary camp, Mary, the mother of Jesus. This would be primarily Catholics that would argue this. You've got the Israel camp, that the woman represents Israel, the nation of Israel, or the church. Does she represent the church? Let's think about these three different options. Let's go back and look at verse 1 and read what we learn about her. It says, a great sign appeared in heaven. The woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet and on her head a crown of 12 stars. Well, notice her clothing, the sun, the moon, the 12 stars. At first, we might be tempted to go back to Revelation 1, where it told us there's these seven stars and they represent seven angels. So we might be like, okay, she's got 12 angels on her head. But we've also got to understand the Old Testament background for the book of Revelation. And we see this is almost word for word right out of the Old Testament. A dream that a guy named Joseph had in Genesis 37. It says Joseph had another dream. And again, he told his brothers, he said, hey, the sun, the moon and 11 stars bowed low before me. Joseph had 11 brothers. His dad was named Israel. This is where we get the name Israel. Actually, his name was Jacob at the time. He changed his name to Israel later. As he tells his brothers this dream. And his dad is like, dude, you really think that me and your mom and your brothers are going to bow down to you? So, but even back when Joseph had this dream, they knew this represented Israel and the 12 tribes of Israel. And so this woman, I think you can make a pretty good case from this that she represents Israel. So if we think about the three camps, Mary, Israel, and the church, I'll give you just three facts we learn about them from this vision. First of all, the clothing with the sun, the moon, and the stars, you know, in its original context, it's definitely Israel. Definitely Israel. Another thing we learn about this woman is that she gives birth to Christ. Which you can see where they would come up with Mary for this, because she actually was his mom. She did give birth to Christ. In a sense, though, you could also check the Israel box for this. You know, I mean, Mary kind of basically was the representative. You know, the nation of Israel was predicted. You guys are going to be the nation that gives birth to the Messiah someday. He's got to come from some genetic line. And God said, it's going to be this one right here. They also, you know, theologically, they recorded the scriptures. They set the context for this Savior that would come into the world and everything that he would do. And so I think you could equally check either of those boxes for Mary or Israel. Now, what about the church box there? Could you check that one? Well, it kind of depends. Is there a difference between Israel and the church? Oh, we keep coming back to this question, don't we? We got there in chapter 7. We got there in chapter 11. And so we've made this interpretative decisions that are now influencing our interpretation of this. Now, it doesn't mean that those earlier decisions are chiseled in stone and they can't be changed. No, sometimes you get to a passage and you're like, maybe I need to go back and take a look at this. And maybe I need to rethink. You know, I had things on both sides of the scale when I made my earlier decision. Maybe I got something else to throw on the scale. It might cause that first decision to maybe be called into question. You know, the art of interpretation, it's really like an enormous jigsaw puzzle. And you're trying to fit it all together. And I've been working on this puzzle for 17 years now. And I still got a lot of pieces that I can't quite fit into place. There's one where I'm like, all right, I mean, that I think that fits, but maybe not. I mean, it's a black piece with a bunch of black pieces around it. And maybe I'll get some more insight into that at some point in the future. But, you know, what we argued in 7 and 11 is that, yes, there is actually a difference between Israel and the church, that there's a relationship between those two. But you've got two different eras in the work, in the plan of God. And that in these last times, God is actually going to move back to a way of operation that is more centered on Israel again. Partly because the church, there's a good chance the church will be raptured, will be removed from the earth before this final 7-year period known as the Great Tribulation goes down. And you should go back and check out the Revelation 10 and 11 teaching and the Revelation 7 teaching if you want more information on that, because I don't have time to go into both of those tonight. I'm going to say that more and more as the series goes on, too, I'm afraid. So what we've argued is, you know, if you've got Israel and the church did not even begin until after the death of Christ, until Acts chapter 2, then how could the church give birth to Christ when the church didn't even exist yet? You know, if you equate those two, then you could check all three, but you could check the right-hand column all the way down. That, you know, Joseph was referring to Israel, but, you know, that's the same as the church. But if there's a difference, then no, this isn't the church. And so I would say no. We also learn later in the passage that this woman has other children, and Satan will attack them later. In verse 17 of Revelation 12, it says the dragon was angry at the woman and declared war against the rest of her children. When he couldn't get the first one, when he couldn't get the male child, he declares war on the rest of her children. And John tells us these are all who keep God's commandments and maintain their testimony for Jesus. So, you know, that right there, that doesn't fit Mary too well. It's a little surprising that Catholic scholars would argue for this, because they argue that Mary didn't even have any other children, that she actually never even, she was a perpetual virgin. And so that doesn't really fit too well with that interpretation. I mean, Satan, I guess, I mean, Jesus's other brothers did, when they became leaders in the church, but it's kind of weird to bring that up here in this vision. Israel, though, I think that actually, of these three options, I think it probably fits the best, you know. If Israel, you know, was the one through whom the Christ came into the world, then, you know, you could maybe argue that Israel's children could be the church, you know, other nations, other people that would come to faith. You know, God said that Israel is supposed to be a light to the nations and a blessing to the whole world. And she has been. They're the ones that delivered the Old Testament. They delivered the Christian faith. It's a Jewish faith, first and foremost. Or it could be some reference to other Jewish believers. It's hard to say. We don't want to be too dogmatic in these. But I'm going with Israel for the woman. I guess you can come up with your own decision on that. So Israel is the woman. Israel, you know, indirectly, I mean, in a sense, through Mary, gave birth to Christ. She did. But we're going to go with Israel. She's with child. She cried out, being in labor and in pain to give birth. The other sign appears. The great red dragon, the 7 heads, the 10 horns, the 7 crowns. We're not going to get into that this week. That comes up next week and in chapter 17. And we're going to really go after that next week. That's where we meet the dragon's two other buddies, the Antichrist / the beast, and also the false prophet. They form kind of a so-called unholy trinity. And we're introduced to those characters primarily in chapters 12 and 13 of Revelation. Those other guys are human beings that play major roles in the end times. His tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to earth. What's that talking about? Well, by far the best explanation I've been able to find on this is that this refers to the fall of Satan. That he's introduced this character who's going to play a major role in the end time scenario, and who has played a major role throughout human history. And he's the vision rewinds all the way back to who is this guy? How did he get to where he is now? And what we learn in the Bible is that Satan was an angel at one point. Remember, it calls him the dragon and his angels. It says explicitly that it's Satan. He was an angel at one point. In fact, Satan may be the most magnificent being ever created. The caricatures of him with, you know, the red suit and the little pitchfork and the horns and stuff. You know, that's not at all. I mean, Satan probably came up with that caricature because it's so ridiculous. You don't realize what a magnificent, brilliant, powerful being he is. Second only to God himself. And so we see Satan, this magnificent being, who apparently was able to convince upwards of 200 million angels, perhaps. Remember, we saw myriads of angels in Revelation 5:11. 10,000s times 10,000s, which is like 400 millions. You can do the math on that at home. But, you know, if there's 400 million left in heaven, and a third of them went with him, then that means he would have upwards of 200 million, wouldn't he? You know, imagine a being who could talk millions of angels who are in the very presence of God into thinking, yeah, why do we always follow Yahweh? Why do we always follow God? This other guy here seems like he's got something going for him. You know, Satan, he was so beautiful and so magnificent, he began wondering to himself, why do I have to be second fiddle? Why? It says his beauty and splendor corrupted him in Ezekiel 28. And he corrupted a lot of others with him. He took down a lot of others to join him in his rebellion. And at a certain point, apparently, the angels were forced to pick sides. And many, many went with Satan. You can see God's dilemma. Satan's like, how come we always have to follow God? And God's like, who else wants to ask that question? And so it's an attack on the character of God. It's brilliant, is what he did. In a twisted, evil way. It's brilliant, though, to get what he wanted. He's a master manipulator. And so we see this being sweeping a third of the stars from heaven. And this is where we get, you know, demons today. They're fallen angels. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so when she gave birth, he might devour her child. Well, we see all the attempts on Jesus' life, starting from the very moment he was born. When King Herod killed all the baby boys, two and under, in Bethlehem. We see many more attempts throughout the life of Christ to kill him. He finally succeeds on the cross, much to his shock and dismay. He realizes he played right into God's hands. He did exactly what God wanted him to do. And we see Jesus rise from the dead and ascend into heaven. But, you know, you see the even longer history of anti-Semitism. Long before the Christ was born, Satan knew there'd be a Savior coming from the Jewish nation. And we see many times his attempts to exterminate the Jews. We see when Moses was a baby, the attempts of the Pharaoh to wipe out the Jewish people. We see many, many, many attacks on the nation of Israel throughout the Old Testament. We've even seen it even since the death of Christ, just this strange, mysterious hatred that so many people have for the Jewish race, for Jewish people. Why is that? Could it be that maybe God's enemy is behind this because he hates them so much? Because they are God's chosen people. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who's to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. Well, at this semicolon, about 33 years go by. And her child was caught up to God in his throne. We see the death, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus. You know, the reason why Jesus came, why this child came. We read in Scripture, this is God the Son, who put on flesh, dwelt among us. Lived a perfect life. He entered this rebellion, this world, to die for us. We who deserve death. He lived a perfect life, and yet he said, even though I'm the only one that's not guilty, take me. And he offered himself up on the cross. He was killed. And yet death could not hold him in his power. And he conquered death, and he rose from the dead. And he told his disciples, you guys got to go tell everybody that forgiveness of sins is now available. Anybody who places their trust in me, who asks for forgiveness from me, who trusts me to pay for their sins, can be forgiven completely and entirely, never to be guilty again. It says, then the woman fled into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God. Well, it says that there she'd be nourished for 1,260 days. What's that about? Well, there's actually quite a long time that passes between verses 5 and 6. It says, then what John is saying is the next thing in my vision, not the very next thing that happened in history. In prophecy, it is not uncommon to find gaps. Gaps that aren't necessarily indicated at the time. And yet later in hindsight, we can see there was a gap, a period of time passed there. I mean, if this whole vision is trying to go from beginning of creation until the end of history, there's going to be some gaps. We're talking 17 verses here. This is one of them. This is a big one. I don't know if it's the biggest gap here. Maybe that earlier one between Satan's fall and between the birth of Christ would be bigger. But there's a long time that passes between verses 5 and 6 where Christ ascends into heaven and the woman flees into the wilderness. You know, the reasons why I think a long time passes there. For one, this 1260 days, this ties this event right into the Great Tribulation. We saw it come up twice last week, twice this week, next week. Also, we're going to see in the Old Testament this comes up. And there it also ties it to the final 7-year period of human history. And so it ties it in with the Great Tribulation. So it wouldn't fit back in the first century A.D. Remember, we saw in Daniel that there's one final 7-year period allocated to the Jewish people. And this is it. We're picking up the clock in that 7-year period. Also, the context is all Great Tribulation. Everything we're seeing in this whole part of Revelation is Great Tribulation. And it just doesn't make sense any other way. There's no real way to fit this in. You know, if it's Mary, you know, Catholic scholars try to argue this is where she went down to Egypt to escape from Herod. But, you know, that goes out of order. And I guess order can be transgressed. You can kind of be fluid in these situations, but I already argued it's not Mary. So, and what's the whole nourished for 1260 days? Yeah, it doesn't make sense any other way. And so one possible meaning here, what this might be teaching about the end times, is that during the last days, a group of believing Jews will flee Jerusalem, it looks like, flee the battle, the mayhem, the slaughter of that time, specifically the slaughter of God's people. But it's going to be a bad time. We've seen the seals and the trumpets are done already. It's going to be bad. And apparently they're going to flee and be protected by God. They're going to flee and be protected by God. What's our basis for this? What's our support for saying this? Well, for one, there's a historical precedent. In Luke 21, Jesus warned believers. He said, it's not going to be too long from now that Jerusalem is going to fall. And he says, you've got to get out of here when that happens. He said in Luke 21, when you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you'll know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea, that's the area in and around Jerusalem, flee to the mountains. Let those in the city get out. So he says, when you see those armies surrounding, you've got to get out of here. It's interesting. We see in Epiphanius, church historian from the 300s A.D., he says that's exactly what the Christians did. He says the Nazarene sect, that was one of their terms for Christianity, Jesus of Nazareth. He said it exists in Berea, Pella, and Bashan. These are areas east and northeast of Jerusalem, across the Jordan. He says that's where the sect began when all the disciples were living in Pella, after they moved from Jerusalem. Why did they move? Christ told them to leave Jerusalem and withdraw because it was about to be besieged. Where is this area? Well, you can see this map. You can see Jerusalem is right there at the top of the Dead Sea. This is Israel in modern day Jordan. Pella is this area right up here. And so you can see they crossed the Jordan. They went up north to a place where they thought it would be safe. It was kind of a different region politically up there. And they knew they'd be safe up there. And apparently those settlements of Christians, there were still many Christians there a couple hundred years later, 300 years later. Here's Eusebius in his History of the Church, early 300s A.D., about 325. Here's what he says about this event. He says the people of the church in Jerusalem had been commanded by a revelation vouchsafed or entrusted to approved men there before the war to leave the city and dwell in a certain town of Perea called Pella. And so here we've got multiple historians from the church fathers saying the Christians left because there was a prophecy that said, get out of there. Otherwise, you're going to be slaughtered. And that's exactly what happened. It was a massacre. It was a bloodbath in Jerusalem when the Romans sacked it, tore down the temple, fire, execution, many prisoners taken. Josephus, here's an interesting secular historian from the first century. Check out what Josephus says. He narrates the war. This is his book, The Wars of the Jews. And he narrates this Roman general, Cestius, shows up with 400 troops and surrounds Jerusalem in 66 A.D. And you're thinking, well, Jesus said, get out when they surround Jerusalem. Well, wasn't that too late? Well, check this out. Check this out. Okay. He has to withdraw. And in the withdrawal, he loses most of his troops. Rome has to send another stronger force down in there to take out the city. But what Josephus tells us is that between the surrounding of the city and the withdrawal from the city, he says, many of the most eminent of the Jews swam away from the city as a ship when it was going to sink. You know, he doesn't say it's Christian, but he does say specifically several prominent names in the Jewish community got out of Jerusalem after this surrounding and then this withdrawal. What, you know, were there Christians among this number? Were they warning other people because of the prophecy of Christ? You got to wonder. And I think this is just yet another notch on the biblical fulfilled prophecy that we've been slowly rolling out piece by piece throughout the course of this series. And as we often do at CT whenever we get a chance to. I think this is remarkable. But the point is, there's historical precedent for this attack on Jerusalem and then a flight from Jerusalem. Jesus warned about the one in 70. But he also gave the same warning to believers during the Great Tribulation. You know, that attack on Jerusalem in 70 AD becomes kind of like a picture or a foreshadowing of one that will then happen in the end times. Oh, yeah. That's why some people get them confused. The preterist camp we talked about first week, they get these confused, the thing in 70 and the thing in the end times, but they're different. Check out what Jesus says in Matthew 24. He says, when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So this is in the middle of the Great Tribulation. The Antichrist is going to, after rebuilding the temple, he's going to desecrate it somehow. And he says, that's your cue to get out of Jerusalem. Flee to the mountains. He tells them to go. And it looks like in the last days, some believers are going to be savvy enough to follow Jesus' warning, just like they did in 66 A.D. and they got out of there. Also, when you read the Old Testament, you see a picture of the end times where Jerusalem, Israel, is just overrun by armies in the middle of a tremendous battle. Zechariah 12. And that day the Lord will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And in that day I will set about to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. This actually refers to probably an event at the end of history, although it could be protection for these believers that are escaping as well. And this is also pretty interesting, I think. The Old Testament also predicts certain safe zones that won't be conquered by the Antichrist. Daniel 11, a passage about this final world ruler that we'll learn about next week. It says the Antichrist will also enter the beautiful land, Israel. Many countries will fall, but interesting, there's a few that won't. These will be rescued out of his hand. Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. What are those countries? Well, in case you're not up on your ancient geography, these right here, Edom, Moab, and Ammon. It's a desert. It's a dry wilderness. It's very mountainous area in there. Apparently, that's the place to be when the final battle goes down. Ironically, close to the action. Although maybe if you can't get that far away, that's where you go. I suppose Australia might be a good place to be as well. Hawaii, perhaps? I don't know. Edom, Moab, and Ammon. You know, you read some Christians and they throw around this Petra as one possible place that these believers might flee to in the end times. I don't know if you guys know what Petra is. It's in Jordan. This is one of the sandstone temples that are carved right into the rock. You might recognize this from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, perhaps. This is where that final scene takes place. It's quite a remarkable area. They've got their own freshwater spring, and it's not just this one here, but you've got hundreds of caves all over the place, all cut into the mountain. There's another shot of it. You know, it was actually unknown to the Western world until the 1800s, and somebody discovered it. And it's kind of a, at least it was a tourist attraction before things got real dangerous over there. I don't know where they're coming up with Petra. I mean, maybe they've been watching too much Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. But, I mean, it's possible, I guess. I don't know. What this is teaching, what this seems to be teaching, though, one possible meaning of this is the flight of certain Jewish believers in this last time to the safe place. I don't know. There was war in heaven. Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. And the dragon and his angels waged war. So you've got this battle going back and forth between the angelic hosts, the angelic armies. And, you know, when angels battle, it's not like lightsabers and stuff. And, you know, I don't think it's like magic powers. When you see angels, when you see Satan show up in the Bible, he doesn't show up with like a flaming bow and arrow or like a magic wand. What he shows up with is lies, a story about God that's maybe partly true, but off just a little bit. It's a battle of truth. It's a battle of ideas. I mean, maybe there's some sort of brute force component, but it looks like it's one big argument. That's all he's doing whenever he shows up. It's like he's picking up the thread from where he was last time. You see, in the Old Testament, there's places where Satan waltzes right into the very throne room of God and just starts launching accusations against God and against God's people. And so we've got this battle between Michael and his angels and the dragon and his angels. And, you know, these guys go way back. They used to be comrades. They used to be buddies. They used to be friends. And this rift just split right through the angelic ranks. And here they now stand against each other on opposite sides of the battle. You know, back in the Civil War, Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant, you know, Lee was 16 years older than Grant. But during the Mexican-American War, these guys fought right alongside each other. Lee was Grant's superior. And here they found themselves 14 years later standing on the opposite sides of the battle lines in the Civil War, having to go to war against their old buddy. And so we see generations, we see millennia here of history, and we see this battle going on. It says the dragon and his angels were not strong enough, and there was no longer a place found for them in heaven, and the great dragon was thrown down. The serpent of old, the devil, Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. All right, so here we've identified the characters, but the question we've got is, when does this take place? When does this take place? When did this happen? You know, there's really three options here when this might have happened. The first one is that this is another account of the fall of Satan, that he's basically going back to verse 4, where the stars were swept down from heaven, and it's giving more detail on how that happened. And, you know, that's possible. It's possible this is a kind of a restatement of that with a little bit more detail. But if you notice, there's some differences. It's similar but different. Did you notice in Rev 12:4 that it says Satan was the one who threw down a third of the angels, a third of the stars? But here, what does it say? Satan and his angels were thrown down. And so in the one case, he's the actor. In the other case, he's the, you know, the object of the action. He's the one being acted upon. And so it seems like it's maybe different there. Also, Satan is still in heaven in the Old Testament. Like I said, there's places where he enters into the heavenly courts and he argues with God. And yet here, you know, it seems to be saying, it seems like there's some sort of finality to it. As we read the next couple verses, you'll see just how final this seems. Well, another option is that it's not at the beginning of history, but it's at the center of history, the death and resurrection of Christ. You know, we do see that some sort of a tremendous victory was gained over Satan there as well. Just like in the beginning, you know, here a tremendous victory is gained. And Jesus says in John 12, now judgment is upon this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. He says that, you know, it's the same word. The casting out of Satan. And it's tying it to the cross. And it's true that at the cross, Jesus won some sort of a tremendous climactic victory. In Colossians 2:15, it says he disarmed the rulers and authorities, referring to the demonic realm, with what he did at the cross. You know, all the lies about God's not looking out for you, God's just looking out for himself. Well, that's really proved false by the cross, the ultimate act of self-sacrifice, isn't it? A third possibility, though, and one that I'm actually partial to, is that this is something that is still future. That this is something that will happen at the Great Tribulation. Someday, some sort of battle that happens, maybe in the middle of the Great Tribulation. You know, it fits with the order of Revelation chapter 12 pretty well. You know, this whole thing is actually, it's basically chronological, at least up until this point. If this is not a restatement of verse 4 in the fall of Satan. And also, you'd be rewinding to go back to the cross at this point. So it does fit with the order of the vision. Also, as we read the next couple verses, we'll see it looks like this battle is not just a battle with Christ, but it's a battle that's been ongoing with believers. And, you know, here it's Michael and the other angels are attributed with the victory as well. So it looks like this actually takes place after the cross, many years after the cross, after a long and hard fought battle. Let's read on here. John says, I heard a loud voice in heaven, and it was saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, he who accuses them before our God day and night. And they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb and because of the word of their testimony. And they did not love their life even when faced with death. It looks like this is talking about humans. Angels can't die. So it can't be talking about the angels. This is talking about some sort of part that human beings play, believers play in this battle with the evil one. And that finally God says to Michael and the other angels, he says, all right, fellas, it's time to take out the trash here. It's time to throw these boys out of heaven for the final 3.5 years, for the final period of history, because we've got some stuff we need to take care of. Apparently God has seen enough at that point. And so I want to just take a moment here and talk about a little application, because in this passage, even if this is about a future event, which I'm slightly inclined to think that it is, okay? If I had to vote, that's what I'd vote for. We see the strategies of Satan, you know, the way Satan works, even in our lives today, they spring out of who he is. And we see three titles for Satan here. And the first one we saw is this one right here, the accuser of our brethren. Remember it says the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, who accuses them before God day and night. Notice, too, the word devil. That word is literally to throw against. The compound word. It's the one that throws things against. That's what, like, his title is. Like, if your name was Against Thrower, that would be kind of like analogous to Satan's name. Also, even the word Satan just means the adversary, and it's got legal background to it. You know, he's like a wicked prosecuting attorney that has no regard for truth. He'll lie, he'll say whatever to attack you, the defendant. So he's an attacker, he's an accuser, he's a hurler of lies to defame the character of God. Also, accusations toward other people, accusations toward your home group. You wonder where those come from? Could be God's enemy. All your negativity about other people, all your suspicion of their motives, that's unrighteous. But oftentimes, it's toward you, the accusations. I found that to be often the case. You know, I don't know if any of these ring a bell. These were a few that I thought of the other day. You're such a failure. You're not good like these people. You know, this idea that there's just some fundamental difference between you and them, and that's why you can never succeed, and that's why you should give up. You know, you're just too emotional. You'll never be able to stand firm. You ever get that one? Man, I used to get that one all the time. What about this one? You're just too unemotional, and you'll always be distant from people. I used to get that one all the time, too. I'd get them, like, in the same day. It's so weird. Depending on how I was feeling in the moment, I guess. You're damaged goods. Nobody's going to want you. You're going to be lonely, rejected. You know, you've messed up too much. You've been a Christian for how long? And you still haven't gotten that area of your life together? You still don't have a thriving prayer life? You read the Bible and you fall asleep? What's wrong with you? You're a failure. You're an idiot. You're defective. You might as well just quit. You know, if people knew your secrets, they would be horrified. You can never tell. This, like you can share some things, but this one right here, this one goes to the grave, okay? There's probably people in this room right now that have been thinking that. Have been thinking that maybe for a long time. Maybe God's bringing something to your mind right now. I got to tell you, the solution to that is to open up about it. You can't believe the relief that will come if you come clean on that area. Don't listen to those accusations and lies. You've been trying to serve God for years now. What do you really have to show for it? Man, you should be a lot further along by now. Anything you might say that you have to show for it really isn't as good as you might think. You might as well just quit. You're just not leadership material. This is as far as you're going to advance in your service for God. In fact, you've already advanced too far. That's why you should just quit. You know, it's a pattern in a lot of these. It's blah, 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 blah. And that's why you should just quit. That's why you should stop fighting in this battle. There's a battle going on, guys. There's bigger things going on here than, you know that sense that there's life out there, there's something bigger out there, that sense that there's a spiritual realm. This is where that comes from. There really is a lot more going on in this universe than the human race. And yet the human race is the focal point because of Jesus Christ. What is the solution to these accusations? Well, we see right here. They overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb. Notice what it doesn't say. They overcame him because they were just really righteous. And no sin could be found in them. No, that's not what it says. We don't agree with the accusation. That's not how to battle these. To think it's spiritual or humble to agree with the lie. We don't take vows. It's not they overcame him because they vowed they would never do that again. No. That doesn't work either. That's not how spiritual growth works. It's not arguing based on my merits either. You know, our great hope is not how hard we hold on to Christ, but how he holds on to us. That's our hope as Christians. That's where we put all of our faith, all of our trust in him. The blood of the Lamb. I'm amazed at how many mature Christians I talk to who still don't know how to put on the righteousness of Christ. That's where you don't argue based on my own good deeds, but you argue based on his and his alone. We don't mix mine in there. We say, yeah, you're right in a sense. I did that. I do this. I'm this way. But it's a good thing. It's not my righteousness that counts here. I'm just going to take my stand on Christ. That's what you've got to learn to say if you're ever going to make it. And if you're ever going to grow spiritually. We also see the serpent of old who deceives the whole world. Yeah. He's the master liar, the father of lies, Jesus called him. You know, the world system, what the Bible calls the world system, would fall under this heading. This is just a system of other temporary pursuits that we pursue instead of God, and we just never seem to get around to investing time in the things of God. You know, it perpetuates the, if I could just blank, then I would be happy. You know, whatever you plug in there, look better, have more money, be more comfortable, accomplish more, get this person's approval. It's all the world system. It's all a big deception. It won't make you happy. The doubts about God, the labyrinth of cynicism that some of us are stuck in right now, gets us turned upside down. False religion, the belief that any other way besides Jesus could get to the Father, that's all lies set up by Satan. And the solution for this, what we see right here, they overcame it because of the word of their testimony. The cure for lies is truth. And it's not just knowing the truth. We've got to know it and we've got to testify to it. That's where I say here, I talk about it. Here's how God has impacted my life. Or I talk to myself about it. About how God has changed me, how God has saved me, how thankful I am. Part of who we need to talk to is ourselves, but also to other people. And it's the word of our testimony, how I can personally attest to God's goodness. And also how I can declare his word. And finally, we see him as the great dragon who persecutes and devours. One more title here in this passage. And wouldn't you know it, you know, we see in our lives, we see family members being nasty to us. You know, meanwhile, my sibling that's not following God, they just think that person's the greatest thing ever. We see coworkers passive aggressive jabs at us. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever gotten that, but you may. Those jabs about what you're involved with because you're not conforming like the rest of them are. I think there's a bit of conviction that people feel. It's partly why they're doing this. You know, there's when things break right when you're about to serve God in some way. Man, you should see my house on days that my wife or I have a big teaching to do. You're amazed at what goes wrong. That never goes wrong. Yeah, we'll have to put up with some of that. And, you know, we're choosing a life where instead of spending my time, energy, and money on me, I'm choosing to sacrifice for other people. There's time sacrifices. There's sleep sacrifices. There's all kinds of things that buffet us and wear us down. And I got to say, this is a lot more intense in other countries. You know, it bothers me when Christians whine about persecution and they totally ignore how people are actually being slaughtered for their faith in many parts of the world right now. But in the end times, there's going to be plenty of that to go around in every part of the world from everything I'm reading in Revelation. And so, and the believers that originally were reading this, this would have been comfort to them as well, to stand firm in this battle. The solution to this one, well, of course, you guessed it, Revelation 12:11, they didn't love their life even when faced with death. Some of us were not standing up to persecution because we still have not made a break. We've not offered our lives up in discipleship. Christ said, you can't serve two masters. You're going to hate one and love the other. You're going to despise one and serve the other. If you want to save your life, Jesus says, you need to lose it for my sake. There's no compromise position on this. And so some of us really need to consider, have I made that decision? Not a decision to become a Christian and receive forgiveness, but a second decision to give my life over to him, to offer myself up as a living sacrifice, as Paul says in Romans 12. Well, let's read through the rest of this passage. It says, for this reason, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. So this is a good day for heaven when Satan is cast out. Not so good for earth, though. Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you having great wrath, knowing that he has only a short time. Not a good time to be living on earth. That's one reason I think this is end times scenario. Seems like a final push of Satan down to earth in preparation for the last series of judgments. Well, when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. This could be a further persecution. This could be picking up the thread back in verse 6 where he left off. could all be right around the same time that all these events are happening. But the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman so she could fly into the wilderness to her place, where she was nourished for time, times and half a time from the presence of the serpent, 3.5 years. Mark that number for next week. Some sort of divine protection is given to her, you know. In the vision, she's sprouting wings and flying off. This is Old Testament imagery, though. God said to Moses and the Israelites after rescuing them from Egypt, he says, you saw what I did to the Egyptians, right? You know how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself? It's a picture of divine rescue. Like in The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings, when the eagles always show up. And the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman, so he might cause her to be swept away with the flood. Another attack on the woman. Water from the mouth of the serpent. Don't know what that really means. Some sort of attack. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and drank up the water which the dragon poured out of its mouth. And so the woman's standing there in the vision, and the water, the flood is coming right toward him, and all of a sudden the earth's like, and the water just cascades over the edge. And the woman's like, yeah, that's right. This is just more divine protection of some sort. It's highly symbolic imagery here. This will probably be clearer after it happens. So the dragon was enraged with the woman. And he went off to make more war with the rest of her children who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. So he turns and he's like, you know what? I've had enough of that woman. I'm going to go attack others. You know, remember there's 144,000 who are sealed by God who seem to have some sort of special protection. It might be that at this point he goes after others who don't have that seal. Their persecution of believers is intense during this time. So looks like he's going after them. And for this, he appears to have some sort of a new strategy. A secret weapon, if you will. As it says in verse 18, then the dragon, John sees him, take his stand on the shore beside the sea. And then in verse 13, 1, I saw the beast rising up out of the sea. And that's what we're going to get into next week. So, what we've seen in Revelation 12. Let's think about this. More predictive prophecy. Some fulfilled already, some yet to come. We've seen also there's a great battle raging and you've been drawn into it. This is not like, should I enlist or should I stay over here in America? No. The battle is all around us. This is not optional. I mean, you can call time out. You can be like, oh, I'm actually not playing. And that doesn't work in war. I got to tell you. That's a good way to have your spiritual life devoured, annihilated, to be rendered completely ineffective and to have a whole lot of regret when the end of the battle is here. Because, you know, God predicts who's going to win. In the end, the Lamb wins. Spoiler alert. That's where this is all headed. And no matter how painful the battle feels now, we know that as Christians, we're on the winning team here. And so will you join the victors now? Will you join up by inviting Christ into your heart and by telling him, I don't want to just be a Christian that's sitting on the bench. I want to be somebody that sees battle here. I don't want to be standing there at the end of history and everybody's telling their war stories. And I'm like, yeah, I just gave up. I didn't do anything. Do you want to have that conversation when you're standing there in heaven? With all these people, they've got their wounds. They've got their tales of how God came through. And you've got your story about all the money you spent on your television. About all the time you sunk into your career that's really pretty pointless now. Is that what you want? Or do you want to be like, you know, I wasn't perfect. I made a lot of mistakes. But I stepped forward and I said, here I am, Lord, send me. That's what I want. Hope you want that too. And so we come to the end of the dragon the first member of the unholy Trinity. Next week we meet parts 2 and 3 of that triumvirate, the beast and the false prophet. We've got time for questions now. Now, if it's your first time, we've got a free book, a free drink. You can stop by the coffee bar to get that. If you've got a question, though, why don't you raise your hand? And we have one microphone orbiting, and I also have a microphone of my own this week. All right, Cooksey, you ready?
Cool. So something I was thinking about was like this verse in 1 Peter 4, where he's like, "Dear friends, do not be surprised by the fiery ordeal that has come to test you, as though something strange were happening." And so it's kind of this idea that it's like we're doing God's work. We shouldn't be surprised when we face like really intense like opposition or whatever, because like Satan, like, he's not described as a dragon because he's like, it's something like some cool word or whatever. It's because he's like out to really like oppose the stuff that God is trying to do through us. And so when it comes to like doing God's work, we should expect that there's going to be a lot of opposition. And it is something that's real normal.
Yeah, we think that because I'm in pain that I'm doing something wrong. And in fact, it's just the opposite. I may be in pain here because I'm doing something right, and I may be in no pain because I'm doing nothing. I'm not even trying. I'm not, you know, you think about the areas in battle, the areas that are going to draw the most fire from the enemy are going to be the, you know, the areas that are most important for the victory. You know, if you're flying a plane in on a bombing raid and there's no anti-aircraft fire or anything, that probably means you're bombing cows out in the country somewhere. You know, what they're going to have, they're going to have the anti-aircraft guns around their factories and stuff. And so if you're not drawing any fire, it may be that there's a reason for that. So good. Yeah, over here.
So I was curious why God would allow Satan to continue to be in heaven until the tribulation, or even until the death of Christ. If you pick that view, I thought God couldn't stand to be around sin. So how do you reconcile that?
Well, I mean, we see Satan in heaven talking with God. And, you know, in one sense, God is everywhere. So God is, you know, it's not like God, we can ever get away from God or anything like that. So, but as far as why God would allow Satan to have any sort of a hearing still in the heavenly courts, well, for one, it's that point I made earlier of Satan's like, you know, God, he's such a control freak, and he wants what's best for him alone, and we're just his minions, and he's not a servant leader, he's a selfish leader. You know, if God just like, you know, zapped people that said that or censored them, you know, that just gives credibility to the lies that they're spewing. And so God's in a delicate position there where what Satan's doing is false, and yet to censor him just makes him look even more like God's covering something up. And so it seems that what God has done for a period of thousands of years, I don't know, he's allowed Satan to have freedom of the press. And then God answers those by his actions that he takes, presumably in the heavenly realms, but here on earth, and especially in Christ. And that's why it says that he disarmed the satanic angelic authorities in Colossians 2:15 at the cross. He disarmed them because their greatest lie that God's just looking out for himself. From now on, God can be like, look at the cross, dude. And there's no way. I mean, Satan is the one who was really exposed at the cross for all of his conniving, attacking, slimy, selfish ways to kill God's innocent son. And God was vindicated as, I'm offering myself up freely here as a sacrifice for rebels that hate me. And so it's part of God's plan. You know, he is going to silence evil one day, but it looks like the way he's dealing with evil is he's dealing with it in such a way. You know, if you think about it, Satan rebelled and took, what, hundreds of millions of angels with him, perhaps? Then human beings rebelled. So he's already got multiple rebellions on his hands. And, you know, is this just going to be an eternal string of rebelling creatures? And so at the cross and through Christ, he's going to do away with evil once and for all. And it's going to be in such a way that in heaven, it's not going to be like, oh, I want to sin, but I'm going to try not to. But it's going to be like, oh, my God, I never want to go back there again. And other beings, we'll get to testify to other beings. They're going to be like, so, dude, what was it like living on earth in a fallen world? And we're going to be like, oh, let me tell you about it, you know. And we can tell not just about what life under sin is like, which we have no idea how bad it is now until we see how good it can be in heaven. And we also get to tell him about God's mercy and grace and how he saved us and how he loved us and how he didn't deserve it. And we're going to understand that a lot more fully in heaven as well. So we're going to be like the ultimate witnesses in for eternity future is seems to be the picture the Bible paints of this whole thing. It's a tricky question, though. It's pretty deep. So I gave you my short answer there. You know what? We should pray.